It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, of course, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as we begin the program, just to remind you, please don't hesitate to give them a call. And we've been talking about this a great deal. Justification for making that call is to prepare yourself for any unexpected events. And I might add also to avoid very costly events in the future. So that number, easy number to remember, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
So the topic for the day.
Sure. Wes, tell us what we're going to talk about.
So, Lockwood, we all kind of know that if we find ourselves in a situation where we receive either through the sheriff or through certified mail or mail, or and we're served with a summons, a complaint. It could be for money owed, or it could be, you know, family situation involving property that's owned in the family. It could be anything. We kind of know that if you just kind of set that aside and don't do anything with it, that's probably not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to talk a little bit about what happens if you are served a summons and complaint and you don't do anything about it. We're going to kind of get into the details about that.
Okay.
What does that really mean if you do not pay attention to that legal issue? So basically, that if you're served a summons and complaint, you're probably going to see your name on what we say on the bottom side of the V. It's going to be a plaintiff versus defendant. You're going to see yourself, your name there as a defendant. Okay. And so that means that obviously some type of civil action, in most cases, it would be a civil action, has been filed against you. And that could be, you know, for anything. And mm-hmm. It could be legitimate. It could be not legitimate. It could be a mistake. It could be, you know, a credit card company has got the wrong name. I mean, it could be anything.
Right.
Okay. So when you receive that, obviously there's a summons attached to it. And this summons is normally a yellow sheet of paper that has some bold language on it that says that, you know, a civil action has been filed against you and you need to respond. And normally it says, if it's state court, within 30 days, federal court, normally within 20 days. And so we just want to walk through the process of what happens if you just don't do anything with that, don't show up to court, don't respond, don't do anything from a civil context. So if that's what happens and you don't respond, then the technical process that then is probably going to take place is that the plaintiff's attorney who is representing the side that's found it appropriate to file a lawsuit against you within that or after the expiration of the time period for which you are responsible for providing your response is going to seek what's called an entry of default.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, entry of default. And basically what that is just a very kind of a perfunctory type administrative process that the clerk of court enters. Okay. You don't have a hearing on this. You don't go to court for this. A judge doesn't decide this. It's just a somewhat of a ministerial task or a task that's just based on the paper
mm-hmm.
where the clerk looks at, okay, number one, the plaintiff is seeking entry default against this defendant. The clerk looks to see if that defendant was served.
Uh-huh.
And they'll see if there is return of service from the sheriff or there's proof of service from like certified mail or if there was, you know, service by publication. They're just looking to see if there is what we call Rule 4 service. That's mm-hmm. just a rule under the rules of civil procedure. And if they see that that is in the court file, that there is proof of service, and they see that that 30 days has come and gone and there's been no response, okay, to that complaint, then they will sign a document called an entry of default. And all that is saying is that we're entering default because there was no response within the time period prescribed by law. Mm-hmm. All right. So what's the effect of that entry of default? Well, the entry of default is just that determination that there was no response. And the legal effect of that is a admission of all of the allegations in the complaint. That means that everything that's stated in the complaint against this defendant and everything, period, against the complaint or in the complaint is admitted. Okay. So you lose your opportunity at that point in time to be able to contest the merits. I mean, it could be that what is stated in the complaint is entirely false. Mm-hmm. It could be that it's mistaken. It could be that, you know, and I've certainly seen this happen, many times, actually. Sometimes, let's say, defendants or individuals have names that are close to the same right. name, and they mm-hmm. sued the wrong person. Or a company has a really close name to the company that should have been sued, and that company was sued. And so just because you're the wrong company, you know, and it doesn't mean that you just ignore it.
Okay.
You still got to deal with it, because once that entry of default hits, then that is an admission of all of those allegations. Now, with the entry of default itself, you can't go use that to go collect against a defendant, to go force the sale of their property, to execute on it. That's not good enough. You've got to get to the judgment stage. And so once that entry of default is entered, and let's say you learn about it at that point in time, maybe you get a copy of it in the mail or whatever, right. and that's, you didn't realize what happened. Maybe the service, maybe it was handed to your 14-year-old child right. at your house and they didn't give it to you.
Right.
Maybe it got stuck in the mail that came into your business. You know, but you learn about the entry of default. Well, at that stage, if you're kind of toward the beginning of the case, then it's not that hard at that point in time to get that entry of default set aside. The standard is pretty low to set it aside. But again, if these are all things that. These are all reasons why you should hire an attorney if you right. ever get that summons and yeah. complaint. I'm just digging into the details a little bit so that people know how it works. So the further you get down the path, the less likely it is that a court is going to set aside that entry of default. You know, I've had cases before, Lockwood, that the other side has hired an attorney after there's been an entry of default. And the case has gone on and on and on for, you know, months or even longer. And there's been discovery that's been done, depositions that have been taken, you know, interrogatories served, and we're all going down this path. And the attorney fails to actually set aside the entry of default. They just didn't do it. And so here we are about to go try the case, and we still have an entry of default there. And we've all relied upon the fact that there's an entry of default, and the court denied setting aside of the entry of default.
Wow.
So when we try the case, it's not going to be about the liability. It's not going to be about the allegations that are made, because all of that is deemed admitted, every bit of it. Mm. It's going to be about the damages aspect of it, and that's it. So... but be that as it may, you want to get right on these issues as soon as they become, you learn about them. Because the further you get down the path, the harder it is to deal with it. So we're at the entry of default stage. So the clerk has entered default, and that's an admission of all the allegations in the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just where, you know, where we are. So the next usual step, it could kind of go two ways, would be that if there is that entry of default, there's no response, then you follow up with what's called a motion for a default judgment. And that can work in two different ways. You know, one way is if the complaint has an allegation of a sum certain in it. That means that if the way they pled the case, they plead the exact amount that they're entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and sometimes you'll see in a complaint that there's an allegation that says, you know, defendant, you know, John Doe owes plaintiff, you know, $10,350.
Right.
Well, that's a sum certain, or a sum certain could be John Doe owes plaintiff an amount of $300 per month running from such and such date.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the clerk can calculate the sum certain by looking at how many months there have been.
Right.
So if you can calculate the sum certain, then the clerk, without a hearing, has the right then sign a default judgment, which is just as good as a jury verdict and judgment, which is just as good as a final resolution of the case. Okay, so the entry default is the first step, and then the default judgment is the second step.
Mm-hmm.
In the event that the default judgment or the complaint does not include a sum certain, then in most cases you have to file a motion, notice a hearing, and put on your evidence, like an affidavit of what the damages are that you're entitled to, and the court will consider that evidence to calculate your damages. So if there's no response to that as well, then the court is going to enter that default judgment. And then, like I said, that's just as good as, you know, a full, you know, a jury verdict and, mm-hmm. and judgment. And so then that judgment is entered. And then we're at a point where, you know, you're really going to have to show the court a heck of a lot to be able to get that set aside.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you didn't know about it, then maybe you're going to have to convince the court that you didn't know about it. You know, you're going to have to really put on some good evidence to show what happened with regard to this. And the law in North Carolina with regard to you know, setting aside default judgment, if you look at the different cases where, you know, the court has considered that, is, to put it lightly, the court is not inclined to do that. Even if you have, like, for example, there's a particular case where the defendant received the complaint, and it was a company. And it was provided to the appropriate department, which was the legal department. The legal department provided it to the insurance carrier. The insurance carrier's responsibility was to hire counsel and to file a responsive pleading, mm-hmm. and to defend the case. So the company itself acknowledges it was served. It acknowledges that it gave to the appropriate channels in its company, acknowledges that the failure was within their company or by the insurance company,
right.
that it was insuring them, and they didn't do what they were supposed to do. And under those circumstances, it kind of seems a little heavy-handed to punish a defendant that really, you know, basically gave it to the attorney,
uh-huh.
you know, to handle through their proper channels. But the Court of Appeals came back and said, we're not setting aside that default wow. judgment because that's not good enough.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't, but the key there is you've got, even, I mean, if you're like a day late or a week late or a month late, even, maybe you'll be okay to get it set aside. But the further you get down the path, the less likely it is that the court is going to give you any relief. They take entries of default and default judgments and setting those aside very seriously. And you got the further you get down the litigation path, the less likely you're going to get any relief. So it's very important to pay attention to your business, you know, with regard to that. So,
I'm wondering, quick question, yeah. on that particular case. I guess really the court is saying, Well, since you were in receipt of the summons, you knew that it was there. You should have been following up possibly with your insurance company, finding out what the status was. So they basically were saying that just because I passed it off or a company passed it off doesn't mean that you have basically passed off the responsibility as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think that they were basically, the court was saying, you know, wow, did you follow up? You know, did you make sure it was being handled? That kind of thing. And I think there was a timing element as well. I think a little bit of time, too much time went by. The court were not allowed to be set aside.
Right.
So again, you know, kind of moving on to then what happens next, you know, folks just need to recognize that this is a situation where you just can't allow these type, mm-hmm. you know, legal situations in your life to not be handled properly. You could normally, you know, if there's a mistake in the complaint or whatever, handle it pretty quickly and get it dealt with. But timing is incredibly important. I mean, whenever I have a client come to me who has been, who sits down in my office and they've got that yellow sheet of paper with them, they walk in and they've got a summons and complaint. I see that summons. Well, the first thing I want to do is I want to grab that summons from them and look at it closely, look mm-hmm. at the date of it and see and ask them, you know, when they were served, because, you know, I don't really care about the merits of the case that much from the beginning. I just want to make sure we don't have a default situation that creates a whole host of problems before we ever get to the merits. So in many cases, I will take that summons, and in the first 2 or 3 minutes of the meeting, I will get up, I will go walk to my paralegal, I will give it to them or give them a copy of it, and I will tell them, go pull this court file right now on your computer mm-hmm. and tell me the status. Because if there's an entry of default, then I've got to tell the client, okay, there was entry of default, it was entered 5 weeks ago, I think I can get that set aside. I've got to stop, drop, and roll and do that
right
today.
Yeah.
Okay, that's before we even get to the merits. And then what if they say, well, this is not even me.
Right.
I don't know why I've got to do that. I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to get that set aside.
Right.
Because if it's you or not you, it doesn't matter. We have to get that set aside. Okay, period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the first thing I'm doing. If there's a default judgment, then I'm looking at when it was entered. I'm looking at the details. Why did you not respond to it? You know, why did you just learn about this? You know, those kind of things. So it's like, you forget the merits of the case as the attorney. You don't really care about what happened in the case. We're going to get to that.
Right.
What we have to do is we have to get your case back on the railroad track
uh-huh.
because it is severely off the railroad track right now.
Ooh.
And hopefully the court will allow us to get it back on the railroad track. So that's, you know, kind of A number one. And, you know, folks listening to this kind of get it. I hope timing of this is incredibly important. even if the entry default or default judgment has in fact been entered, it's not as though you can't do something about it. I had one recently where the judgment was entered against my client. There was entry default against him, and then a judgment over $1 million was entered against him, and he was in fact served, but then he moved. He was served at his business,
right.
And then he moved to somewhere in Greenville, North Carolina. So when he was served notice of hearing on the default judgment for over $1 million, he actually did not receive the complaint or the notice of hearing
right.
for the default judgment. He just didn't get it, so he didn't go to court. But he didn't provide any information to the court that he was moving and his service address would change.
Okay.
So default judgment had been in place for like a year or two. He learned about it because he was wanting to, I think, do like a refinance or something
right.
like that. And all of a sudden that popped up that he had $1 million. So what did we have to do with that? Well, we had to kind of do surgery on that case. Basically, we had to look very, very closely at whether the attorney for the plaintiff made any mistakes mm-hmm. in what they did in the case, because I knew the chances of getting a default judgment set aside under these circumstances was not high. Uh-huh. So we pulled the file, looked at it incredibly closely, found that there was a mistake of like one day with regard to the notice of hearing. They had to give notice of hearing of 10 days plus 3 days, which is the what's because the service was by mail. That's the mailback box rule. But when you give service by mail, you have to give 3 extra days, and they gave 12 days, even though it really didn't make any difference. He didn't know about it anyway. It did from a technical right. standpoint, and that was a basis upon which the court set aside that $1 million judgment. Again, these are things that are hyper-technical that have to be dealt with in a timely manner. If we're at a point where there is that default judgment, you haven't done anything about it, you haven't heard anything about it, you don't care, well, and then you're not going to be able to get it set aside, or your attorney, you have finally hired an attorney and the attorney was not successful in setting aside, then you've got a judgment against you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just what it is. It's just like the judge or the jury coming back against you. It's the same thing. And so you may have a sheriff knocking on your door to collect on that judgment. You may find that there is an action to sell your real property, mm-hmm. you know, to satisfy that judgment. So that's the effect, you know, of that. And by the way, the $1 million judgment that I was just referring to the young man, relative to the young man that we got set aside, in reality, he probably owes a little bit of money, but it's probably about $5,000.
Wow.
Not a million. It just was kind of a, right. as they some people say, trumped up, mm-hmm. you know, claim. It was saying just a lot more than really what it was factually. Kind of the moral of the story with regard to that is this is, as folks kind of know, respond to these issues quickly. Get competent legal counsel to deal with it immediately. Don't let these type situations slip down the path. That's what people need to know. Now, what we've, and just about everybody kind of understands that, but what we've done today is kind of dissected it and kind of picked it apart a little bit. There's more detail that is probably beyond what we need to go into with regard to this radio program, but just deal with it immediately. Now, also with regard to your family, you know, sometimes we see situations where elderly folks find themselves right. on the wrong side of a case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got an elderly parent, or you've got an elderly family member, or even friend, sometimes these folks aren't in a position to be able to understand what to do, not right. because of their, you know, cognitive ability per se, but more because of their cognitive deficiencies mm-hmm. based on their age.
Right.
That has the same effect. I mean, just because someone is elderly doesn't mean that they're immune to these things that we've talked about. Now, if the elderly person has been adjudicated incompetent in a court of law, then that's different. Then the person who would have to be served for the elderly person would be the guardian, you know, not the actual person. So, and then the guardian certainly would have notice of it, but that's not really a reason to have someone adjudicated incompetent. But you just kind of need to monitor, you know, your affairs of your family members. Now, I would say that if you had, you know, an elderly individual who was served with a summons and complaint, and we could document that they have diminished capacity, maybe their doctor would do an affidavit indicating their inability to handle their affairs, those kind of things, even if some time had gone by, that's going to be a factor the court will take into consideration. The court, if your evidence is good, would mm-hmm. certainly, you know, probably lean more towards setting that aside. I mean, we're not going to punish an elderly person who just didn't really ignore the situation. They just don't know they don't have the capacity anymore because of their advanced age to deal with things. So again, you get to an attorney quickly to deal with those that situation as well.
You said a few moments ago that it's conceivable that a summons would probably be delivered to an individual who may not be really directly involved. Maybe a family member, maybe have been left at a desk somewhere. It got lost, things of this nature. Is there some form of coverage defense by saying, no, I never received, in this particular case you gave of that young man, I never received the document? Is that part of the argument in the case of, you've got to, go ahead.
It is, but it's whether the court believes what you're telling it or
okay.
not. And so we talk about Rule 4 service. So the most common type of service is going to be personal service.
Right.
And that's normally going to be by, in North Carolina state court, that's going to be by a sheriff deputy
okay.
appearing at the property and handing it to the defendant.
Okay.
Okay. That maybe as common would be service by certified mail restricted delivery, it being delivered by this certified mail or like right. UPS, FedEx, restricted delivery to the named defendant.
Okay.
So what are we going to have there? We're going to have an affidavit from the deputy as to whether that personal service took place.
Uh-huh.
Right. So that's the first thing. Or we're going to have a certified mail receipt indicating that it was in fact delivered to the particular, you know, person. Okay. Now where it gets a little more sticky is where we have service at the residence. You don't have to hand the summons and complaint to the actual defendant if you take it to the residence and hand it to a person of suitable age and discretion.
Okay.
Okay. And so if you hand it to a 3-year-old, that's not good enough.
Right. Okay.
If you hand it to a 14-year-old, that probably is.
All right.
So, you know, it's kind of a subjective standard. You know, but you can get into a situation that, you know, that service on the through suitable age and discretion, you know, it's kind of questionable as to whether it was in fact good service or not. Now,
okay.
if you end up in court over that, then the court may certainly be asking the question, you know, what's the normal process in your house with
mm-hmm.
regard
right,
to mail?
Right.
I mean, if it was handed to your 14-year-old and you say you never got it, I mean, where is mail put?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have it put on a dining room table? Do you set it on, you know, a desk somewhere? Does everything get thrown in the trash can? I mean, what do you do at your
yes,
home?
Right.
You know, and do you have a process of, you know, periodically someone, whether it be you or your spouse or someone, kind of going through that mail and making sure that your bills are looked at, making
mm-hmm.
sure all those things are being paid. You know, obviously a summons and complaint with a yellow cover sheet on it, so, you know, mm-hmm. handed to someone, that's going to kind of stick
yeah,
out.
That's gonna,
how,
yeah.
how did you not see
right,
that?
Right, right.
You know, that, so
yeah.
we can get to that point, but really, you know, the devil's in the details.
All right.
There.
The other question for you, and again, just to remind folks, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're talking about summons and something that we've discussed in the past. Do not ignore them. Quick question on the summons, the initial summons. What is the operative term of a response? Is that basically a matter of denying the charges in the summons or the challenges in the summons? What is a normal activity in the response to a summons, just really right out of the gate? And then I'm sure it gets a little deeper, but what's the first action in response to that?
Yeah, it's called an answer.
Okay.
And so basically what you're doing is that you are answering each of the allegations
okay.
of the complaint. You know, you're admitting them or denying them or saying you don't have sufficient information, therefore denying them. And then you're raising your affirmative defenses, which is incredibly important, and which you know a non-attorney wouldn't know to do. But
mm-hmm.
for example, let's say that a credit card company is suing you on a debt that's 8 years old,
mm-hmm.
or 6 years old, or 5 years old, and well, there's a 3-year statute of limitations. Well, the credit card company is late then, but if you don't raise as an affirmative defense, you know, North Carolina General Statute 1-52, which is what would apply there under a contract. This is a 3-year statute of limitations as an affirmative defense. As a matter of law, you have waived that affirmative defense, and the credit card company doesn't have to worry about it anymore.
Gotcha.
So in most cases. So it's not only responding to the actual allegations so that they're not deemed admitted against you, it's also raising the appropriate affirmative defenses. I mean, you could have statute of limitations. You could have, you know, let's say it's on a real estate contract that wasn't in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you don't raise statute of frauds, which means, you know, certain types of contracts has to be in writing and signed, then you've waived that. I mean, there's a whole host. Okay. There's dozens of affirmative defenses that we raise all the time for claims that just don't have any merit. Because of the affirmative defenses. So if you don't respond and raise those, then you really set yourself up for potential liability when you could have very easily avoided, you know, the liability.
Well, and in this day and age, and we won't belabor it, but the probability of scams I know of particular circumstances where people have been charged by, for example, tolling companies, challenging them on having failed to pay their toll based on actually fallacious information. So, yeah, I can appreciate that. One quick other question before we wrap it up with you, Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins with us this afternoon. And again, we're talking about summons, something not to ignore, pure and simple. Settlements in the case of a summons. Is it conceivable to, if there is a summons and there is obviously a failure on the part of the recipient of the summons, is there a possibility that settlements can be arranged before it gets too far into a court case?
Absolutely, but the likelihood that the plaintiff is going to want to settle with you goes down considerably if they have an entry of default in their hands, right, or a default judgment in their hands.
Right.
I mean, if you've got your case on the railroad track, as I've said, you have not allowed it to get off the track.
Right.
Then the likelihood of a favorable resolution is much higher. And the reason why, one of the main reasons why, there'd be many, but one of the main reasons why is because the plaintiff, if they already have an entry of default or default judgment in hand, then they know that the attorney fees they're going to have to spend to advance this claim to a win for them is going to be much lower than if they don't have that in hand.
Uh-huh.
If they don't have that in hand, what do they have to do? They have to prove their case.
Right.
They've got to engage in discovery. They probably got to go through mediation.
Okay.
They've got to take depositions. All that means dollars. So, and those are dollars that they may not be able to collect on their judgment, even if they do win. So therefore, if there's a entry of default or default judgment that is entered against the defendant that wants to negotiate a settlement, you know, that defendant is negotiating from a much weaker position, which doesn't normally bode well for a positive resolution in favor of and that the defendant would agree with.
In conclusion, call immediately. If you get a summons, don't delay, right? And my final?
No doubt about that.
All right.
I've said it a dozen times this morning, at least.
252 area code 726-9050. That's Harvell and Collins. Call them immediately. You can also stop by their office there on Bridges Street in Morehead City, directly across the street, as a matter of fact, from the City Hall. Look, take advantage of this. With that, Wes, Cecil, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. With this acknowledgement, don't hesitate to give them a call. Thanks for your time on here. Let's Talk Legal.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you, Lockwood.